I put down as an authorship here with lots of help. Basically, I'll be talking about work that I did with Jerry many years ago and have corresponded with him for all that time. But then since then, there's been a lot of people that have taken up different kinds of aspects of what we originally worked on. And to me, the take home on that is that so much of what he did was sort of a seed for a lot of what other people have taken up since, both directly and indirectly. A lot of people really, even who didn't know him, were benefiting from that work. So did we just hit return? So I was in a situation when I first worked for the ARS many years ago, where I'd been doing work in small plots, kind of like we just saw in the last talk, and I went out and measured crop growth and fertilizer movement and all kinds of things very intensively, measured the crops, measured the plants, measured the growth in great detail. And then I got this job in a watershed, and they said, well, let's apply that kind of idea to the watershed. It's the same principles, right? Okay. So we have this area. So the place I landed was in Idaho, southwest Idaho. The watershed's 239 square kilometers. Have an elevation range of over 1,000 meters. Lots of snow, all kinds of things I was unfamiliar with. We always brag about how intensively it's monitored. I mean, there are these weirs on here, three or four weirs, and several soil profiles. That's nothing compared to what I had been doing in the past. I'd look out on the landscape there, and so the idea was, okay, how much water is flowing through a weir? So this is the way to do it, huh? So how much water is coming out of this little weir here? How much forage is produced on the landscape? So the forage is for cattle primarily, and the water is for a whole host of applications, including irrigation, water, and a lot of water-related things. This is a dry part of the country, and people are very interested in water. Vegetation is critical. That's what's using most of the water that doesn't leave. But if you look across the landscape, it's kind of like, okay, what's the vegetation out there? Well, if we look up there, we see conifers, we see aspen trees, willows, shrubs, juniper trees, shallow soils, deep soils, grasses. Kind of hard to say exactly what's out there. If you turn around and look the other way, you see, there's different shrubs and rocks sticking up and a little irrigation down there. And there's a whole lot of it. So how are we going to measure all this stuff? That's where I started thinking, I think remote sensing might be a way to do this. We're out there, so when I go out there, we start getting a stick and measuring the plant height and dimensions and everything, and you get some great information over, you wouldn't want to measure a room, area the size of this room that way, that's for sure. That would just be killer. So, of course, we had much smaller plots than that, and we continue to do that. I mean, there's certainly value in that kind of data, but to really apply it to a landscape is something that I personally can't imagine. And then the other issue that's really critical out there is snow. So we talk about how much precipitation you get, how much rainfall you get. Well, in this landscape, you get most of the precipitation is snow. You look over here, and I have a little plot sitting right here. In fact, I know you get maybe 15 centimeters of snow. Not a good year, maybe. Over here, it's about a meter. And then if you go over here in these little piles here, these drifts, you get 3 meters. And then if you come over here, you get maybe 2. On the ridge, it doesn't stick around at all because the wind blows it around and makes piles of it. And so you get piles of it in the drifts. And you have some places that are completely scoured and some places that are moderately scoured. And then you have all these topographic effects. And question, and all that boils down to you have a highly variable precipitation regime in a very small area. And kind of like with the vegetation, how do you know about it? Well, you go out with a stick and jam it in the soil, in the snow, and see how much snow is there. And you can do that for an area the size of this room very nicely. It's beautiful. But to do it across the landscape is quite a challenge. And even here, you can see these precip gauges here. All right. These are 10 feet above the ground. You can go over here, and you can see there's no soil cover. So it's a highly heterogeneous landscape that we're trying to characterize in a way, because clearly the amount of snow influences the vegetation and the water supply. That was kind of my situation where I ran into Jerry Ritchie and also these guys down in Weslaco. And they came out in 1993 to Reynolds Creek with this airplane, this Aero Commander. And they wanted to, they brought they were going to do some multispectral videography. That was real cool at the time. And laser profiling. And I was very interested in both because I just was interested in remote sensing. But I was particularly interested in the laser profiling because that was one I kind of believed, you know. I mean, he came into the office with this little box, opened it up, shot it across out my window at the parking lot and said, oh, yeah, what do we have here, 120 meters, you think? Yeah, okay, we're good to go. I mean, I know what that measurement means. See, some of these other ones I wasn't quite so clear on, you know. But the laser profiler, yeah, it turns out, as one of our previous speakers noted, it's a little more complicated than that, actually. But the fundamental number is just a distance, and so I could interpret that. So I had set up all these transects across the landscape and different vegetation types, and I was really excited about getting the height of the vegetation and the distribution, spatial distributions, and amount of bare ground, several parameters I thought we could get using this laser profiler, and. And there's just a couple of examples. This is a low elevation one where we have a lot of bare ground and primarily shrubs. At the higher elevations, you can see there are trees in there and it's more mixed. And so we went out and flew these things and I was real excited about it. I'd driven all over the place, set up all these transects with the bearings and the markers and monuments and everything. And then you get in the air and we did a couple, and then we come to the next one, and I thought, oh, yeah, we'll start right there. And when we got there, I realized it wasn't quite there. It was over here. And the pilot, Renee, I said, oh, gee, I guess we missed that one. Sorry about that. No problem. And he went back around like that, and boom, there we were in the right place. Of course, my stomach was still back on the first one, and so... The next thing I remember, I was staring at this bag and not feeling very good at all. In fact, it's really a bad feeling. And they were talking back and forth. And then I remember Jerry saying, no, I think it's chartreuse. And I realized they were talking about the color of my face. Took sympathy on me and kind of flattened things out because I was the only one that knew where these darn points were, but I was obviously out of commission for a while there. And so we flattened out and things calmed down and we carried on. And there were other issues with that, but I'll pass on this for now. So we collected it, pretty interesting data, and got things like one of the things that we found, another, and this is particularly interesting to Jerry, was these channel cross sections. So you could fly across the creek and get a transect of the heights, and you could see where the main channel is and see where the floodplain is. And I thought that would be really useful for kind of monitoring changes in the channel. There's a big issue then about grazing and how it affects channel cross sections and stuff. It turns out that is a little tricky with a laser profiler because you don't actually know exactly where you are. You know almost where you are, but you don't know exactly where you are. And so to repeat this transect is kind of tricky. But the other thing was the vegetation, and that was very interesting. So what we got was these data kind of like this. This is from the upper one I showed you where there were trees, and this is somewhat raw data where you see the whole topography and you see these bumps here being trees. And then you can subtract out a ground level and just get the vegetation. So we had, these weren't very big trees, but they're on the order of 4 meters high. And then you can see the surrounding shrubs and stuff that were down below. And you can make a histogram for the vegetation type up, which I thought was going to be really, really useful. Turned out the histograms all look a lot alike, unless you have some of these outliers in there. And so those data were really useful, and I thought that was a way that people could use to characterize large areas. And also the multispectral stuff, which I'm not going to show you, but I thought, okay, these are really two useful tools that land managers could use for looking at the landscape. So I went to the Bureau of Land Management, who manages gazillions of acres in that part of the world, and worked with some of the range techs there, and I thought things were going well, but we never got past the starting phase. And so in frustration, I went to the director, and I said, yeah, these guys are great, but, you know, we never get anywhere. What's going on? And he just looked at me and said, you know, there's no way you can make us use that stuff. So I realized that that's probably not going to go very far. And so I said, you can't fire me, I quit. But you can't keep a good idea down for too long. It turns out a little bit later, some people in the BLM working in Idaho talked to some people in Las Cruces, New Mexico, who happened to talk to a fellow named Jerry Ritchie, because he was doing work with LIDAR, which I'd heard about too. And they thought, boy, you know, we have this issue in Idaho and Oregon and a lot of the West, where this vegetation change, and basically what's of concern to a large areas is the increase in this plant species, this tree known as Western Juniper. And I put this picture in here because it kind of illustrates what's happening. There are places where the juniper are completely taken over. There are places where there are no juniper, and there are places like this where it's coming up. So if you look across this landscape, you see little tree here, little tree here, little tree here, all these little trees. And they grow fairly fast into big trees. And as they do that, they basically convert a landscape like this into one in which you have juniper trees, which at this point in time, no human has figured out a use for. And dirt. Basically, all the understory, the forage, of course, that's what the ranchers are interested in, is gone. And then there's other questionable issues about what happens to the water supply. Anyway, they decided that they heard that maybe LIDAR would be a way, which is a direct descendant of these laser profiles that we were doing. That might be a way of characterizing how the landscape is changing, because you could quantify say, okay, how big are these trees? Where are they? How much have they changed in the last X number of years? And you can quantify it and then hopefully design your management appropriately, because there are different ways you go after this beast depending on the density of the cover. And it worked. You know, they said, okay, yeah, let's do LIDAR. And so we went from you can't make us use this stuff to all of a sudden, they gave us a whole bunch of money to get LIDAR data from all over the place. Here we have, this is our 239 square kilometer area, but we also get data. We had data here and other large areas that we had flown that the BLM basically paid for. And we were interested in that for other reasons, not just for the juniper height thing, which is actually not that tricky, but one of them is getting back to the snow issue. And this is kind of interesting. There's a previous talk here that addressed some of these issues that came up. But what we did here, so one of the things about the canopy cover is that it affects the amount of direct sunlight hitting the snow, which of course affects how fast it melts, and then also how much of the long wave radiation is retained underneath the canopy. Again, has a big impact on snow melt and accumulation. So. The question is, how do you use LIDAR to inform a model that would tell you what kind of shading characteristics you had? Here we took some, and I didn't do this personally, this is just people that I work with, but taking aerial photography, where you have a forest and you have shadows, because and you know the time of day that the picture's taken, and then making synthetic trees that have the same kind of structure that creates the same kind of shadow that you see in the real picture. And knowing this angle of the sun and whatnot, you can kind of make a synthetic forest. And that kind of looks like that. You have a synthetic forest, and then use that for your simulations of what your energy balance is over the snow. And we wanted to, so that's one of the things we wanted to use the LIDAR for. And it turns out, of course, the other one is, there are a couple others. One of the others is to have a really nice DEM, because when you look at a 15 meter or 30 meter DEM, which we try to squeeze a little more accuracy out of, there are all kinds of issues involved in that. But with this, you can take a 1 meter landscape, and you can drape that, or you can drape a photography on top of that, and you can then drape your LIDAR derived trees, and you can put that in the context of the whole landscape, and you get a really nice kind of picture of what's going on in the landscape. And you've got it with the topography, and you can see where the snow accumulates, and it makes for a really, really nice tool for looking at what's going on with the hydrology of these basins. The other thing we want to do is be able to use the LIDAR for a snow survey instrument. So you take a LIDAR image of the place when there's no snow, and then you come back a few months later and take a LIDAR image of it when there's snow on the ground, and then you take the difference, and you have a snow survey for a large area, which is great compared to walking around with a stick. And so, but there are issues still, and this goes right back to this previous talk we saw. If you look at these trees here, these conifer trees, you know, they kind of look like trees, but actually, they're not. They're cones. There aren't any trees in nature that really look like this. And then if you look at the aspen trees, well, they look to me like pup tents, kind of. Aspen trees don't look like that. I don't know if that's just an aesthetic complaint or if it really affects how it affects the energy balance, but that's something that we're doing some more work on, just looking at constructing trees in small areas and getting the morphology of the tree, and then looking at a woodland, and as he was saying, it's the forest for the trees issue comes up. The other issue is kind of resolution we get with the LIDAR. This image, it's not terribly clear, but I think you can see this little line across here. And that line, so this is a DEM that's shaded relief. It's just not really all that well shaded. Maybe it's okay. Anyway, so we have this line coming across here. That's a road. And if you look at the numbers of that road, it says that the road is sunk in the ground about that far. Which it's not, because you can walk along the road and you see that it's sunk in about that far. Actually, it's hardly sunk in at all. And that's an error in our LIDAR processing. And what the problem is that, and that has bad implications, because for one thing, it makes a river right here, where, of course, there is not a river there, but that's quite a little channel run through there. So that affects all the hydrology, all your calculations of stream flow, et cetera, are totally messed up by having this river running across the middle of your watershed. The other thing that happens, the other thing is that you realize, okay, why is that channel sitting there? And the reason is that with the processing that we're doing now, and we're trying to fix this, but we're not distinguishing the ground from the top of the shrubs. So basically, the reason that the road appears to be shrunken is that wherever the shrubs are, the processing is saying, okay, that's the ground height. And so actually what we're seeing is a map of the shrub height and not a map of the ground level. And it depends on the density of the shrubs and stuff. In some places it works fine, other places we have these strange issues. And that's kind of important. It gets back to this mapping the snow depth thing, because on a landscape like this, if you have, for one thing, the shrubs to a large extent control how deep the snow accumulates. If you have a windblown environment, once the shrubs are topped by snow deposition, the wind will take care of the rest. The other thing is that even when that's not the case, you're still trying to get a difference. If your snow depth is a meter off, I mean, that's a lot in this environment, because we may have as much as 1, 2, maybe 3 meters of snow accumulation. If you're a meter off, that's a huge error. So the reason I said in the title, two steps forward, one step back, is that this is a graph that I made with Jerry in 1994 from the data we collected in 1993. And it shows the difference between the ground height measurements that we made and the laser profile data that we got. And if you go back to that very same site that we are doing the LIDAR with, and we're getting the river in the middle of the watershed, and we have a meter error, that corresponds to this point right here and an error of 3 centimeters. And so despite the fact that we can show little movies of all the things spinning around and trees and colors and all that stuff, we were a lot more accurate in mapping the vegetation height with the laser profiler quite a few years ago. I'm sure we'll fix that, but anyway, it's kind of amusing to me, and I just was happy to be able to do this talk, because over the years I talked and corresponded with Jerry ever since that first work we did back in 93, and I think he influenced a lot of people in direct and indirect ways. That's for talk.
Yeah, make it your worthwhile. You have have you come with a way of handling that error with the road and the height of the shrubs?
Well, I think as of this minute, I would say maybe. we're actively working on it. We're getting a lot more data in detail. And it's basically, it gets down to how you do the windowing and how what you call zero, and there's a lot of issues involved. But we're pretty sure we can solve the issue. If you look at the raw data, you can see the ground and you can see the shrubs. It's not that the shrubbery is too dense. There are places where the vegetation is so dense that you can't see the ground. That's true. But that's a very small problem compared to this other one. And it's just a matter of, obviously, you can't just look at point cloud for hundreds of square kilometers. You have to have some automated procedure, and so far we haven't quite got that worked out.
Well, thanks, sir. Bill. Just one other question, Mark. What's the price tag on some, like creating that map over that study region? What would that cost?
You mean the cost of the LIDAR or the cost of
the LIDAR collecting that data?
I don't remember what the final cost was. It's really a long story on the price. We had several issues that came up, including the flight. The company that came to fly it crashed their plane. It took us an extra year and a half to get any data. We switched companies about 3 times. Changed. Anyway, I can get you the numbers. I have them, but I don't know right now, because they changed quite a bit over the course of the project. It was a hairy project in that respect. But the prices change a lot. I mean, it's one of those things that's coming down a lot. Even over the course of the time that I was involved in this thing, you could see the prices going down. So it would be cheaper now than whatever it was we did 2 years ago.
What was the spot size of the individual laser? I mean, the individual points you were looking at.
So the points are multiple centimeters.
Okay.
Like little discs. Right. So that's another issue, because you get first and second returns, and it's not actually a point. I mean, that I originally thought of it as a point. It's not actually a point. It's same with the laser profiler. It was a stretched thing. maybe 10, 12 centimeters. And so you can, you're also looking at the strength of the return. And then the posting was, that is, the frequency of points was less than a meter. It varied a little bit because we went back and forth. Sometimes you had multiples within a meter. Sometimes it was 80 centimeters or something like that. On average, it was about 70 centimeters.
Okay, thanks, Mark.